Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We have the pleasant task of talking about the defense from this win over the Bills on Sunday Night Football, starting off a big week in Baltimore sports, we hope. And here to join me to do that is Childs Walker of the Baltimore Sun. Childs, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Ken. Thanks for having me again. And as you said, it's certainly exciting to be talking coming off the Ravens' best performance of the season today.
Yeah, great great game there, and we've got the birds the next 3 days. I'm kind of shortcutting some of the things I'm doing with football this week, but I think we're both pretty focused on the Orioles not repeating what happened last year in the playoffs.
Yeah, it's, as you said, it's an exciting time for Baltimore sports, but I think it's also, you know, certainly a nerve-wracking time on the Orioles side of things. I mean, the last two and a half months were more tough than pleasant, I think, for Orioles fans, and, you know, and frankly for the team as well. You know, you heard Brandon Hyde, I think, in recent weeks talk about how difficult it's really been and how they really have not had the answers at times, but, you know, they have their lineup back, and, you know, I think they're going in on an optimistic bent. So we shall see, but I mean, it's going to be, if they go out quickly this time, it's going to get a little dark, I think. And you will have people calling for major changes. I don't think we're going to see major changes, even if they lose, but that will be the tone of things.
It is really, honestly, a very similar thing with the Ravens when the Harbaugh haters come out in droves anytime the Ravens lose two consecutive games. Honestly, there's enough of them that they'll start talking even after one loss. How many more times are we going to live with losses like this? Blah, 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 right? You know, and anything the team does wrong, an individual problem, coordinator issue, it may be a position specific coaching issue that comes up, it's always the head coach's fault. It's always the head coach's fault from the position of any fan. They don't even know who the position coaches are in a lot of cases.
And I find that the negativity is so much more rapid and so much more violent than it used to be. But then I wonder, I mean, is that just because of my job? I'm more aware of it. I see everything, you know, I'm paying attention to social media every day, which of course amplifies the voices, yes, of the harshest critics. I mean, that's a big part of it, but it sure feels different to me than it did 15 or 20 years ago. And I don't know if it feels that way to fans, but I mean, what I said, it feels like it just gets dark so quickly when things, mm-hmm, don't go right for either of the main teams here.
Yeah. And you know, what is really bad about it is, it's awfully darn similar to political sentiment in the United States right now. And we don't talk politics on this show, other than, right, I'll say that, you know, the left and the right cannot agree on anything right now. They just cannot agree. And they spit ass at each other in every direction. And that's basically, I feel, what we've got between people who hate Harbaugh and people who say, we've had a great stability here, let's maintain this kind of thing. You know, it's not like I'm not immune to the notion that there could come a time when Harbaugh needs to replace. I just don't think we're even close to it right now. And I think that the critics for Harbaugh who don't realize how important he was, how central he was to making Lamar Jackson who he is today in terms of just accepting it. I mean, the Ravens, yeah, are the first team to do this. And, you know, so, anyway. All right. enough of a complaint. Let's talk about what's really going on, because we had a great football game on Sunday night. Very satisfying primetime win. They are now 21-3 in primetime at home during the Harbaugh era. Ravens really put on a great show at night too. I kind of like appreciate that part of going to the games.
Yeah, it is a tremendous atmosphere, which I think is, I mean, you certainly always get the sense from listening to Harbaugh talk that he is disappointed that they don't get more primetime home games.
Yes,
I think because he knows that it's a great atmosphere and that it, I mean, as you say, the record says what it says. I mean, it certainly feels like it works to their advantage, and they are often at their best on that stage. And so, you know, it would be maybe nice to get a few more of those. It's a harder night for me, so I don't mind the 1 o'clock games, but but it is fun.
We're in the same spot. I'm a lot older than you, Childs, if people don't know it, but the night football is an unbelievable drain on us in terms of we're up all night doing the analysis afterwards, and I'm sure you're up until probably 5 a.m. writing probably. It is very tough, but the record at home is fantastic. They got 2-4 in terms of their primetime game splits this year, I believe. So only out of six games, they're only getting two at home. I'm sure the Ravens will say something to the league about that and say, hey, look, we want more at home. And I think, honestly, the testament, what we're seeing is not necessarily the home team atmosphere. I think Harbaugh is kind of a master at getting his teams ready to play at any time. And if you go back to London last year, I mean, that's a perfect example of it. They didn't take their bye after London. They just came home and they started playing games again because they didn't want to let the team scatter and, you know, do things that they would otherwise maybe do. And I think he's proven to be highly adept at that. And just the off-scheduleness of a Sunday night game means you have to work through the day and find things to fill your players' lives at the hotel while they're all together there to do that. And they still – I'm not misstating this, right? They still get together in a hotel. It's even for Saturday night, right, for a Sunday night game?
Right. That's still the routine. Yep.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, anyway, defense outstanding. I thought they got after Allen exceptionally well and it all worked out with really the exception of the single play where Jackson kind of lost his responsibility behind the defense. But other than that, 52-yard play, they really put the clamps down on the Bills in this game.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few other plays. I mean, Allen made a couple other really nice tight window throws. Against close coverage from Brandon Stevens, I think especially those two completions to Keon Coleman. And then, you know, you did kind of feel early in the game that the Bills were having success on early downs. I mean, they certainly did not run the ball well overall for the game, but they did have some nice early down runs right at the beginning that made you think, you know, maybe they could get something going with James Cook. But then the Ravens were so good on third down in the first half. I thought that really set a tone for what they were going to do for the night. And as you said, it ended up being a very complete defensive performance.
Yeah. It's certainly the kind of thing. It was a progressive despair thing that has been the hallmark of the great Ravens teams, whether it's 2000, 2019, 2023, those might be the three greatest Ravens teams of all time. You could throw in 2006 in there as well, but those teams would get ahead. And particularly in 2000 and 2019, they played a ton of dime. And when you have to catch up against the Ravens' dime defense, that is a mountain to climb because they're still pinning their ears back as a pass rush. Then they got six guys who can really cover on the back end. Maybe you try to pick on Roquan Smith. It becomes a lot harder when you've got, you know, six very dangerous defensive players around it. And then it was not true as much, I don't think, with Allen. It's much more true with Burrow, who the Ravens see next week. Burrow does not trust himself, and correctly so, with his limited arm strength, throwing into the teeth of cover two. So he's had very little success throwing deep against the Ravens.
Yeah.
And I don't see that as coming back either.
Yeah, and I think you put it out in your notes today. I mean, Kyle Hamilton has been a particular weapon against that Bengals team, given those sort of bigger conditions. But yeah, I mean, in terms of what you were saying about that kind of constricting pressure that builds over the course of the game. I mean, the Bills pulled Josh Allen off the field halfway through the fourth quarter last night, right? I mean, you know, they waved the white flag, they tapped out. I mean, so that's probably about as good as you can feel as a defense, right?
Yeah, I would agree. I think after the hit from Pierce, the shots they had on his eyes, he did not look like the same guy. And I'm not going to try and diagnose a head injury from a distance, because I'm not sure that's what it was. It might have just been fear. It might have been pissed off. It might have been a lot of things, but it didn't look like he was directing traffic in the same way he was early in the game. And just, he had a kind of an unfocused look about him at the end of that game that was not a scared child look, I wouldn't want to say. I mean, it was just, it was not what I normally want to see from Josh Allen. I won't project too much from it, but he just didn't look like the same guy at the end of that game.
Well, I think he threw just three straight incomplete passes on the last drive that he played, right? I mean, they were done at that point.
Yeah. And you know what I liked about that? You have two coaches on opposite sides who are both the adults in the room, and they understood, we're just trying to get this game over now. And it's almost like they were on a radio to each other, because, you know, they ran the ball five straight times on their final drive to just effectively run the clock out on themselves. And, you know, with Trubisky in the first drive, I think it was run pass, if I recall correctly. Might have been run, whatever it was. It was a get it done with kind of a drive. And that was nice to see. It's nice to see, you know, those two teams trying to get out of there. They know they're going to see each other again, and nobody needs to get hurt, you know, in the closing moments of a game like that.
Yeah.
Fair to say they outplayed the Bills on both sides of the ball in this one.
Yeah. I don't know how you could dispute that. I mean, it is one of those things where, you know, how it felt by the end of the game and you look at the final score, but we certainly couldn't say that there were no nervous moments in the third quarter. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were.
Yep.
You know, when they scored the touchdown to pull within 21-10, and then you know, they have, I mean, the Bills are driving kind of midfield into Ravens territory with a shot to cut it to four. I mean, given what had happened in the previous two games, I think everyone in the stadium is thinking, "Oh no!" Right, and probably a few people on the field are wondering, but you know, Harbaugh had said, when we asked him about losing those fourth quarter leads, that to some degree your best players need to make plays in those moments to get the other team off the field, and they did that last night. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw it with the huge play that Van Noy made. I mean, you know, blows up that trick play and strips Allen, but then, you know, the OA sack, I think, was kind of the final blow that, you know, ends their chances for a touchdown, and then they missed the field goal. And that was really their last gasp. And that was when you stopped having any anxiety about the game. And so there you go. I mean, you had two big pass rush plays when they really needed them. And that's what he was saying.
Yeah. And certainly some great pass rush performances we want to get into. I thought the one thing that kind of disturbed me about this game, and they've now done this several times, I absolutely do not like it. I will be a hooked fish being upset about this thing until they stop doing it. But they went into the game with four defensive linemen again. And they did show some ability to run the ball early, but it's more a risk management thing for me. I cannot bring myself to believe that one extra special teams player is more valuable than, because it's a special teams player on the margin. They may see a lot of snaps. They may not. It may relieve one of your guys from playing special teams, which is another possibility. But the other risk is that you get a defensive lineman hurt, and that's where you can really get yourself into trouble with a guy's playing a lot of snaps on the defensive line.
Yeah. And it's, I do think it's also a more nervous thing just in terms of your performance on the field when one of those four isn't Michael Pierce, right? I mean, you know, the four they had last night were not their best four. Certainly the risk component that you talk about is there. It's interesting. That hasn't really come up with our conversations with Harbaugh over the last few weeks. I guess because they've kind of gotten away with it, mm-hmm. you know, for the most part. I mean, you know, they've been a very good run defense. I mean, you could argue there's been fatigue at the end of games and you know, in those games where they lost leads. I don't know that we've seen that so much on the interior, but it will be interesting to see if they keep doing it and if it does bite them. I mean, I imagine there will be weeks when they play certain kinds of offenses that you will see five. I mean, but clearly right now it's a risk that they're willing to take, and we know how much they prize special teams. So
I want you to give people an idea, because you've obviously been in interviews for many years, and Jeff probably, along with you, hands on the pulse of what's going on in that building and what kind of questions are good to avoid. Whereas there's other people in the media who will ask a question that can sometimes be really be met with vitriol. And not to pick on Jerry Coleman or anything, but Jerry has been a guy who's asked about injuries before when the question was not welcome, for example. So what I've always noticed is that when you ask a question about something he says he's not going to talk about, he can get very prickly and upset with you and say, we're not going to talk about injuries. And then if somebody asks it a second time, you know, we're not going to talk about injuries. You know, kind of thing. If you had a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is asking about some particular thing that the other team does that's different, it's still a football question, but some particular thing about their play, not that does not involve the Ravens, and a 10 is how's Lamar Jackson's current injury situation, where you know you're not supposed to ask it, where would asking about the choice between having a fifth defensive lineman and taking an extra player for special teams fit in there? Because there is an inherent kind of a edginess to that question, I think, when you're asking a coach like Harbaugh.
Well, see, it would depend on the day.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, that's the thing. You just have to have a feel for where he is when he comes up to the podium, and that's part of the gig is, and I certainly don't always get it right, and you know, there's days when the dynamic between us and him is not great, and we don't get a lot of information. But today, for instance, he was willing to expound on pretty much any question he was asked. So I think if he had been asked that question today, and I mean, you know, just for people who don't sort of know the rhythm of the week, I mean, he has a Monday afternoon press conference with us. And you know, that's kind of our time to go over the game with him. And it tends to be the longest time that we have with him in the course of a week. So if you're going to get him to give more explanatory answers, you know, just kind of go into teacher mode, which is often you get valuable information out of that. Monday is really the day to do that. So I actually think you might have gotten some kind of interesting answer if that question had come up today, but it didn't come up. So maybe it does on a subsequent Monday. I would say the time when it would be an unwelcome question is if they just suffered a defensive line injury. Yes. And you know, it's kind of, I told you so. And then that's going to provoke a more defensive, prickly response. So again, it's all about when you ask these things.
There you go. Read the room. You got that right. So before we jump into some of the other things, how about we start from the perspective of your article, because you write an excellent article after every Ravens game. It comes out on Monday. My edition of The Sun, where I get it, doesn't have it. If I looked online, I'm sure I could see it. 5 things we learned about the Ravens this game.
Yeah. And it posts 5 a.m. the morning after every game. Wouldn't usually be in print until the day after that. Because I mean, it's usually done after whatever the print deadline is. But yeah, it's kind of our main item that goes up the morning after every game.
So what regarding the defense, what did you have among your 5 things in this game?
So I talked about something that you have also talked and written about a good amount over the last few weeks, which is the effectiveness of those dime packages that Orr has turned to more and more. And you know, we certainly saw them going to that aggressively early last night. Lots of D-backs on the field. You know, nickel. You know, either nickel or dime on most possessions. With, you know, Trenton Simpson playing a significant role, but not the old Patrick Queen, you know, in on every snap role. So that was the thing that I chose to focus on. And as part of that, just talking about how I do think we've started to see Orr's ability to adapt over the last few weeks. And, you know, we saw, I think, some really nice timing from him last night. I mean, I think you wrote today, he didn't necessarily do a ton of deception with his pressures. But he seemed to have a very good feel for when to mix things up. And it certainly worked in terms of, you know, I think probably the defining image of when the Ravens were on the field defensively was Allen, you know, scrambling toward the sideline, you know, desperately looking for a receiver that often never appeared. And I mean, that that's exactly what the Ravens wanted, right? I mean, so I think you'd have to say Orr probably called his best game as a coordinator so far. I mean, he, you know, we saw signs of it the previous week in Dallas, and then it blew up a little bit in that 6-minute stretch of the fourth quarter. But, you know, it does seem like we're starting to get a sense of what his character as a coordinator will be. And there's a lot of upside there.
That's, first of all, great stuff. One thing I wanted to know was, have you gotten a sense from Orr, or has the question been asked of Orr? And I know the coordinators go on Tuesday, right? Coordinators
Thursday.
Sorry.
Yep.
So won't have a chance for a few days yet to ask this, but it seems like he might've turned off the spigot with relative to McDonald and certainly relative to Martindale on players calling on field stunts for themselves. So they're empowered to do that as long as there's not a blitz, typically. At least that's what Calais Campbell used to say.
Right.
But there's been so few of them this year, it seems like that's not likely to be happening. Like Orr wants to have more control than previous coordinators have. And that's all, I guess it's a feeling out process. And we certainly wouldn't say that McDonald was in any better shape after two games, say, right, than Orr was after two games. And so it's not unfair that this would go. But has anybody asked that question? Anybody tried to get into that?
I do not think he's been asked expressly about his philosophy on stunts. No. I mean, it would be an interesting question to ask him, though.
Okay. And now I was a little bit skeptical of the use of dime, because this summer he answered questions like the dime is one of the tools in the shed. It's, you know, basically when he was asked that question, I asked it at least once to talk about that. But he comes from a background as a weak side linebacker who was on the field for three downs, and very highly valued in Dean Pease's defense for exactly that. And some ways Dean didn't have some other options, so Orr was the best, but he also came from under McDonald, where they've been playing with Patrick Queen on the field, despite coverage deficiencies that would have made him a perfectly replaceable player on third down. It seemed very unlikely, given that set of circumstances in his background, that he would be a dime guy. And yet we've seen this last 2 weeks.
Yeah. And I think his answer to that would be that he would prize adaptability above all. And I think McDonald would have said the same thing, that, you know, yes, I have traits as a coordinator, but I think he probably considered his greatest trait as a coordinator to be able to be a different defense based on the circumstances week to week. And, you know, I think we're certainly seeing Zach try to do that. I mean, I asked him about the dime thing last week, and he said it was a combination of things, that it was partly response of what they expected Dallas to do, but it was also feeling like those defensive backs are quality players and they want to get them on the field more. So it's, you know, there's always been that philosophy with both McDonald and I think now Zach, we want to get all of our good players on the field. And, you know, if we can do that by changing looks, that'll help us keep the other team off balance. And that's kind of what we want to be. And so to me, that's what that answer was speaking to. I mean, you know, he didn't go on and on about it, but that was his message. It's a combination of responding to the opponent and wanting to get all of your best players on the field in unpredictable combinations.
Okay. All right. Well, that is good to hear, of course. And we've liked some of that from previous coordinators, some of the, you know, just basic things like seeing a standard nickel versus some 11 personnel and seeing a jumbo nickel in other situations versus 11 personnel. It's just two different looks to basically make it a little more complex and textured for that offensive coordinator to try and figure it out. Do you want to play with one inside linebacker? Do you want to play with two? And do you have do you want to sacrifice a defensive lineman or gain a defensive lineman to do that? I found that be one of the really positive things about the Martindale era in particular, because he would swap around a lot between packages like that. I think McDonald did it some, much less in his time there. But anyway, I buy it.
Well, and I guess we all should remember that, you know, we tend to speak as if Ravens defense started with Mike McDonald sometimes, but both of those guys, of course, learned under Martindale. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. he was, you know, they were on his staff. So to suggest he would have no influence on those two guys is ridiculous.
Right. Yeah. I love there are people who would say it's not good. It's not healthy to be continually inbred the way the Ravens have been, but they've had so many different, I think, competing and loud voices within their coordinator room, going back to the 2000 Ravens, who had, you know, Jack Del Rio on the staff, who was, you know, ready to be a defensive coordinator at that point, and Marvin Lewis. And I'm trying to think of who else was on that. Brooks, I guess, was still a defensive line coach at that point. Or
I think that's right.
Yeah. So they had a lot of good, loud voices in that group. And boy, these last few years, I mean, you just have to look at where Anthony Weaver and I'm losing his name for a minute because I'm old. The secondary coach who went to Tennessee to be defensive coordinator.
Who was a terrific
Bernard coach. Wilson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, it's good when there's debate there. Culture of debate is very positive. If you're in the business world, I think you recognize that, particularly if you're in a STEM field of any sort, it's usually a very good thing. All right. Want to move on here a little bit, talk about the run game a little bit for the Bills, because you mentioned that they were getting some decent runs early on, particularly in early downs. I thought, you know, they ended up running 23 times for 81 yards, 3.5. No problem with that. But more than that, I think the really good thing about the Ravens in this game was they didn't have any long plays, just a long of 8, which has kind of been a hallmark so far this year of the Ravens not giving up big run plays.
And Allen as a runner did not hurt them, which was huge. I mean, in some ways, as good as Cook is, Allen is the runner on the Bills that really scares you, right? You know, both on designs that take advantage of his power and on broken plays. And, mm-hmm. you know, he had what, one or two plays maybe in the first half, but I mean, that was just not a major factor in the game.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I mean, really the way he hurt the Ravens the most in some ways was a quarterback sneak. And, you know, he got a first down on that. Did he get two or was it just one?
He got the one fourth down. And then I don't know about you. I was stunned that McDermott did not go for the second fourth down
right
on their opening drive. I mean, that made no sense to me. I mean, you go deeper in your own territory, and then I know the next one was a little bit longer than the first one, but why one and not the other? Like, why do you punt in that situation, especially when you have that great a short yardage weapon? I didn't understand that.
Right, that was a little weird. And then they had the other fourth and two. They were getting to, and then the Ravens had the Humphrey injury and then the timeout that was right. one of a really bad Harbaugh moment, frankly. And
he said that today. He said, I was so mad at myself. I just messed that up. And he said, I was furious at myself right away. And he said, when I think back to this game in 5 years and in 10 years, I'll still be furious with myself. He's like, that's just one of those mistakes you can't make. And, you know, yeah, I just blew it.
His lip reading, by the way, then, and he does not often use a lot of scatologies on the sideline, but it's very clear exactly what's going on when that happens in terms of what you can read off his lips from there. But very upset. All right. 5 first downs for the Bills was something, but the Ravens, of course, got 11 on the ground and 271 yards rushing. What did I want to? Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you about. Did the question come up today at all about roughing the passer and the possibility? Did he have the fear, or was he holding his breath to make sure that roughing the passer wasn't called on Travis Jones there?
Did not come up today. No.
Okay.
No. I could certainly see it having been called. I wondered if, weirdly enough, the fact that they ran that trick play made the officials think of Allen less as a quarterback than they normally would if he was.
He is outside the pocket when he got the ball, so he is less of a quarterback.
Right, but, right. Yeah. So I mean, I kind of wondered if that was maybe the reason, or if it was just arbitrary. I don't know, but I mean that was as big a play as there was in the game.
Yeah, it was. I looked at the rule a little bit today, and it talks about the ball leaving the quarterback's hand, and not the pass being released or something like that. It's the ball leaving the quarterback's hand. So I guess it could still apply on a fumble as well. But there's another rule in play here. I mean, when there's a loose football on the field, you're allowed to use your hands in whatever way you like to get to that football and get other people away from it.
Right.
And that includes, you know, knocking people down as they need to be. And so I really think that Allen was fair game at that point. An NFL official might feel differently, and I would have liked to hear it, but I'm very glad nothing was called, because that is as hard a hit as I have seen delivered on a quarterback in the last several years.
But I don't think it was a dirty hit in any way. No. I mean, it wasn't. There was no headhunting. There was certainly no going low. I mean, it was
no weight thrown on top of it, right. Which that could have been big. Yeah,
right. It was just a straight up violent hit from a huge, dynamic athlete. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit. I didn't think that the pass coverage in this game really had any significant breakdowns other than the 52-yard play to Shakir. I thought, generally speaking, they were in the right place for most of the night. Most of the time coming downhill to make tackles, which I thought was also very good.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to talk about the Shakir play at all, but I thought Harbaugh gave a good, I asked him about that today. He thought there were any teaching points off of that. And he gave a good response that I will read quickly if you want to hear it.
Sure.
Sort of explaining how they deal with those plays. He's talking about the way that the Ravens teach this. He said, so the rules are, if you're a deep player, you stay as deep as the deepest receiver. If you're a zone player and you have somebody in your zone, you turn it into man and you plaster them, and then you stick tight and have your eyes on your luggage. So that kind of fell between the cracks there, I think, in terms of just the way the play played out. So we'll look at it on tape. We'll talk to the guys, and I'm confident that we'll do a good job going forward. But it's hard to say for all the scramble plays you're going to have over the course of the season, you're going to be perfect on all of them. I also think you've got to give them credit. I mean, Josh Allen is going full speed to his right, somehow off his back foot. He puts a foot in the ground and throws the ball 50 yards across his body downfield. It's just a really amazing play by a great player. So I thought that was a pretty insightful,
honest,
smart answer about what happened.
Yeah, it's fair. I when you look at the play itself, Jackson came up into an area where he was an additional plasterer. Okay, and they do have that whole right sideline is the active area on a scramble drill right. Okay, I mean there's fire. Then you're the receivers have to get to that point. About the only quarterback who breaks that rule in the NFL right now is Lamar Jackson. He can still throw back to the middle of the field, but regular quarterbacks, any kind of pocket passer, they can't move their feet. They can't, you know, adjust their torso to get their body down there. And Jackson has to maintain his deep zone there. So
right.
I think Harbaugh might be, he certainly doesn't want to throw a player under the bus, but honestly, I think that was a pretty bad whiff by a free safety in a bad situation.
And he did say too that they had drilled all week on the Bills rules on those plays, because the Bills have a lot of those plays just as part mm-hmm. of their offense. And he said their number one rule seems to be go deep when Allen's in that situation. And obviously that's what Shakir did, and they lost him. And I mean, in a lot of ways they played that possession well, right? I mean, he had no receiver for mm-hmm. many seconds. I mean, really until he got all the way to the sideline and had to make a heroic throw. But at the same time, you're right. I mean, they had drilled all week not to do that, and that's exactly what they did. So,
good game for the Ravens in terms of not missing tackles, I thought. And this is a big point. PFF, I'm using them as a guidepost here because different groups have different missed tackle information.
Yeah.
And PFF has a harsh definition, which I kind of like because it's comparable and it's going to have more total data points in it. They had five missed tackles, according to PFF, in this game. As I saw it, three of them led to better results on the play or were contributed to a very good play. Let me put it that way. So, for example, they had the missed tackle by Hamilton that was on that bubble run right where he forced Cook to the outside. Then he missed a tackle, and Jackson came up and cleaned it up for RR minus one.
Right.
And then they had the missed sack by Humphrey, which ends up being a sack minus 16 by Owe. So definitely got that pocket flushed, got Allen feeling pressured on that play. And then the third one was, what was that third missed tackle? Because it was somewhere behind the line of scrimmage. It was Travis Jones missing the sack. And then it being cleaned up by Van Noy, his first right. S-7.
Right.
Yeah.
Right in the first half. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So it was a really good day. The Ravens have had some problems with missed tackles. They've had some problems with important missed tackles, but this was a game where that really wasn't an issue at all, I feel like.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Let's move on to some package stuff. I don't want to talk extensively about this. If you want package information, I'm sorry, didn't you know it's possible
to get THC shipped right to your door. Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary. You can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Produce it in the article. I guess I have to do it at a basic level here this week, because it being a night game, all I did was the star treatment stuff. But the big thing this week, they played a lot less big nickel, so which means that Hamilton was not the slot corner in this game. He was basically either the dime back or the strong safety playing deep when they had three corners in nickel, or even when they're in the base defense.
Right.
It's a big change. Did that come up at all, by the way, Hamilton's usage in this game?
Not with Harbaugh. Hamilton was on the podium after the game, mm-hmm. and I asked him more broadly about the use of the dime packages over the last 2 weeks. And he was very positive about that and said, you know, he feels like Zach has made the right adjustments and it's really paid off, but not at that level of detail where he's talking specifically about the shifts in his role.
Right. And he probably shouldn't. If you put him in a position to talk about that, he might get a little bit of, he's a superstar, so he's not going to get any really serious problem for it, but they'd probably tell him not to do it again if he did. It was interesting because the dime package, they had the big play allowed was in dime. So yeah, that play affected the average by about 2.5 yards, right. But it was about over 6 yards a play they gave up in the dime, and it was under 3 yards at everything else. So it was, but I do not think that at all reflects the importance or the effectiveness of that package. I think it's a matter of sample size, and the one outlier result really, really impacted the thing.
No, I agree. I mean, it's, you know, and again, we've both talked about it and written it. I mean, it's been a major storyline for the team, I think, over the last two weeks. You know, both the amount that they're doing it and what it's meant to their overall performance. So I certainly don't see it going away. Now, I mean, I think there will be opponents against which we see Trenton Simpson a lot more probably. It's going to be a fluid situation, but it's something they want to have in their toolkit, you know, especially, you know, I know we're probably going to maybe talk about Arthur Millett later in the episode, but I mean, they just have a lot of talent back there, and it behooves them to get all those guys in the mix. And that's, as I said, that was part of Ward's answer when we talked about it last week.
It's a good answer. It's also a game script will have a big impact on him. And if it's not an accident that the best Ravens teams of all time have played the most dime of all time. So the number one and number two, the 2019 Ravens played over 42% dime. The 2000 Ravens played 34.5% dime and quarter packages. So those two teams did it
because they led in games,
right,
and other teams are having to come back. And so you, if you're looking for causality, it's kind of like the teams run because they win. They don't win because they run. That old statement is kind of true of the dime as well, is that you play the dime because you win. You don't win because you play the dime necessarily in that causal way. But when the dime's being played a lot, it's a good thing for your team. It usually means game script is going in a direction.
Although I do think we've seen him go to it right away in games. Yeah. I mean, it's not like he's only doing it because they have a lead. I mean, it is clearly something he's seeing as an aggressive tool in addition to a responsive tool.
First of all, 100% agree with that statement. But there's the discretionary dime, and then there's an automatic dime. And your discretionary dime actually comes in on third down, on some down and distance situations, third and four. Do you play it on third and four? Do you play it on third and five? Do you go to it on second and 10? And then for the first half, you get some additional dime packages out of that. In the second half, you can play dime every single down if you're up by three touchdown.
Right.
So it's really the I guess it's the it, maybe those are the discretionary ones, or the ones where you have the lead. What do we want to talk about a little bit here? Yes, let's go back to Arthur Mollett, because that was an interesting point to bring up. Humphrey has looked fantastic in the slot, where I'm sure we're going to talk about that. Washington has looked unbelievably good, and he's having a hard time getting on the field. And Arthur Mollett is now going to practice this week.
Yep.
What do you do?
I do think, I mean, I don't know that he'll be active in Cincinnati. I think there might be a little bit more of a ramp up than that. But I mean, we've seen him working out pretty aggressively on the side for weeks now. So, I mean, he's clearly had a decent amount of physical capability and has been, you know, moving strongly in this direction for a while. So, I mean, it's not like he's starting from zero when he goes out to practice this week. So I do think we'll see him active, if not this week, probably the week after. And I do think they'll play him because they value a lot of stuff that he does. I mean, he was one of their best defensive players during camp. I know you were around a lot for camp practices, and I thought there were practices in which he was the most impactful guy out there. So I can't see them not playing him. It's a good question. You know, who loses out in that scenario, because you can't play seven defensive backs, right? I mean, there are limits to these things. And, you know, you would on one level, you would hate it to be Ardarius Washington, because as you said, he's performed so well with these opportunities that he's gotten over the last few weeks. But maybe that's the answer, because I mean, there is an overlap there, whereas Eddie Jackson, I think, is a little bit of a different skill set. But I think big picture, they would say that you can never have enough of these players. We see attrition in the secondary every year. It will probably happen at some point this year. So having quality players that you rotate in is hugely important. And we certainly saw it last year. I mean, there were veteran reserves who hardly played some weeks, but then became vitally important other weeks. And I think that's how they look at kind of the big puzzle. What will happen immediately if all those guys are healthy? I don't know, except that I would be very surprised if Mollett is just relegated to having no role. But I think big picture, they see it as you can never have too many quality D-backs.
First of all, completely agree. Obviously, it's a heavy attrition position. And they've just lost JAD
Armour Davis. Yeah.
Yeah. To the IR. So he won't be back until week eight at the earliest, right? Because he's missed four weeks.
Right. Yeah. 4 weeks. Yep.
So if you look at this thing, injuries may determine it. They've only really, I think, got one serious play issue currently. Now that could change. But they only got one serious player issue right now on the back end that I think they can address. I think if you thought Marcus Williams was having a tough year, and I think there's some information that I don't think there's another answer. I think Marcus Williams is a free safety. There is not another guy they have.
I agree. And I did think he played his best game of the season, you know, last night. Now that unfortunately was somewhat of a low bar because I mean, of the, of the stars or the clear starters. I mean, he was, I would probably have had him at the bottom of a power ranking of defensive starters going into last night. Did think he was better last night and was part of the good things they did last night. But I agree with you. I mean, I don't see any world in which he's not playing virtually every defensive snap. I mean, that's his role. There's not anybody else who would clearly take it from him.
And if he did get hurt, you don't want to call it a nuclear scenario because it's not quite that bad. Eddie Jackson would move into that role.
Right.
It wouldn't be ideal because Eddie Jackson is free safety time. You know, that's been one of the problems the last 4 years. Jackson's given up 10 yards per target over a 4-year period because that role was really too big for him in Chicago. And he had some bad players around him. There's other things going on. But then you can see things happening already this year where a limited role really seems right for Eddie Jackson, like a split field role that could really be the right role. And yet I think of all the people in the secondary right now, I think Jackson's job is the most up in the air. I think he could if he were to have two more breakdowns like what happened on that play, I think Ardarius Washington could be back there playing a split field role, which I thought, I don't know how you feel about this. I felt like he was too small as a tackler to be used back there. But now after seeing him take care of Ferguson directly and, you know, he's just playing a lot bigger than his size right now.
Well, and I think that's part of the reason they've always liked him is that he sort of refuses to be defined by his presumed limitations. I think that's part of the reason that he kind of won Harbaugh's fancy, you know, pretty early on in various camps. I mean, you know, I think he's been certainly unlucky in terms of health, but there's always been a sense that he's a guy they like, and he's a guy who will often exceed expectations with the role that he's given. And so I agree. I would not limit him based on his physical measurements.
That would be another position they could, I guess, rotate through late in a game to see what Ardarius Washington gives them there, because you certainly have some leeway if you got the lead under certain situations, and they're coming up on a stretch of games where I think they will have the lead in some games, not all of them. You know, Washington's probably better than anybody thinks, and you know Cincinnati's going to be tough, but they probably at least in the next 6 or so weeks will have a couple of leads that they're nursing that they can try and play some of that. Did want to credit Lucas Sipe with the Mullet question. Thank you, Lucas, for contributing that to Film Study Mailbag. If you like, it would be okay if we moved on to talk some pass rush, or was there any other question, any other discussion?
Okay. Let's do it.
All right. So, first of all, I'll just say from looking at this, I did not think it was quite as good a pass rush game. And we saw him running for his life a lot. But they had 15 pressures in this game and only 9 ample time and spaces allowed. Now, that's a really important ratio, the ratio between those two, because ball out quicks are like right in the middle. They're approximately what you expect to get from your overall passing offense, maybe slightly below. But your ratio between how many times you give the opponent ample time and space and how many times you pressure him is really important. They pressured him 15 times. They had 9 ample time and space opportunities in this game. When you're above about 1.3 to 1, that's really good. And, you know, they're obviously at almost 1.67 to 1 in this case.
Yeah.
What was weird about it is Allen was better under pressure than he was with ATS. He had what's called, I call an inverted game
right
in that sense. So he had 9 ATS plays. They went for 31 total yards, 3.4 yards per play. Ball out quick, 10 plays, 46 yards, 4.6 yards per play. That's not good either. And his pressures was 15 plays for 78 yards, 5.2 yards per play. That's about 1.7 yards per play better than I would have in expectation. That included all 3 of the sacks, but it also included, of course, that 52-yarder.
Yep. And you probably expect that to some degree with Allen, who's a fairly unique physical presence.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a very simple formula. I just say if it's ATS, I'm expecting 8.5 yards a throw and BOQ 6 and pressure 2.5. And it wouldn't be the same for you. You're exactly right. It wouldn't be the same for every quarterback. It'd be different for Lamar Jackson as well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But when I get that, I come up with 189 expected yards, and the Ravens actually held him to 154, which is it's not just a reflection on Allen. That's a reflection on the Ravens team defense. They did a great job limiting him.
Yeah. I mean, it was – you know, again, we can say it in so many different ways. I was by far their most complete defensive performance of the year, with, you know, different components working hand in glove.
We talked, you brought up the topic of deception earlier. He did make more use of deception in this game, still made fairly limited use of numbers, but they were amazingly successful with numbers in this game. I just want to read this off really quickly. Let me get to my spreadsheet here. So when they rushed four, which is obviously what they do most of the time, 25 times out of 34 dropbacks or 34 plays resulting in a pass or sack, they rushed 25 times they rushed four, and 6.6 yards per play on that. You could beat Josh Allen if you hold him to 6.6 yards per pass play, but you'd prefer a little better than that. They rushed three one time, 16 yard sack. Okay. They rushed five, eight times. And on those eight times, the Bills gained six total yards, 0.8 yards per play, with two sacks and one turnover. So pretty extreme.
Yeah.
When they didn't know what exactly was coming.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, I mean, you heard over and over last night and again from Harbaugh today. I mean, I think he and the players were extremely impressed with Orr's feel for mixing up what he did with the rush and B, just sort of the timing. They've certainly had effective pass rush at times in other games, but this felt like the one where he was pulling the strings most effectively.
Yeah. You know, if you look back at the first 2 weeks of the season, obviously that's where the problems with the Ravens were. But in the first week, he did not have an answer a lot of people say he didn't have an answer for a linebacker covering a wide receiver in the middle of the field. That's not the root of the problem. The root of the problem was they didn't answer for bunch formations. And they picked and rubbed all the way. So Mahomes always had a guy he could pick on that was on a linebacker, and he was very successful doing it because he's Patrick Mahomes and he's tremendously accurate. In week two, the problem was not being able to react to who Devontae Adams was, or to Brock Bowers.
Right.
And those two guys were the entire Las Vegas offense. They just could not get it figured out. I just thought in week three against Dallas, I thought he had a good set of answers for CeeDee Lamb. And I know they had a great stretch where they went off. I thought that was much more about the Ravens defense being tired. How did you feel about that in the Dallas game?
Yeah, I mean, they were on the field. I mean, partly because of the onside kick, right? They were on the field. I mean, it's late in the game. They played a lot of snaps, but they were also on the field almost continuously for that stretch, because not only did you have the onside kick, you also had a failed drive from the offense. So, I mean, there was no downtime at the absolute worst point in the game.
Yeah, it was 24 out of 27 consecutive snaps they were on the field defensively. So that's a really bad thing. And then they only had four defensive linemen in the game. So your rotational players are getting additionally tired from that kind of situation. Yeah, I felt the same way about that. And I didn't really feel like, I thought in the Cowboys game, he definitely turned a corner, and it's primarily with the dime, you know, and you're obviously hip to this too. So that usage, that adaptation, I thought was fantastic. And then this game, I thought it was, yeah, the dime was still here. He mixed up his packages some additionally, but beyond that, I thought that they had much more variation of pass rush in this game to make them look good defensively.
And it's interesting, I think, despite the variation and the effectiveness using you know, some of the defensive backs, I mean, still the greatest production came from their top pass rushers, right? I mean, even though they're most productive out of, you know, when they're rushing five, I mean, it's the guys ultimately doing the damage a lot of times were the guys you expect, right?
Yeah, there was a little bit of setup for this. Now I want to give you one piece of information about this that I just thought I was blown away by when I saw. So getting into the deceptive elements, they had eight off-ball blitzes in this game. I want to be clear about this. A lot of people talk blitz and they mean five plus man pass rush. Maybe I should call this a zebra or a pineapple something because it would make it more clear that it's something different.
Right.
When I talk about a blitz, I'm talking about an off-ball blitz, which is a single rusher coming from either more than 1.5 yards off the line of scrimmage at the snap, or at least as far out as the slot receiver. Okay. So it means your slot corner might be coming directly. If he doesn't give himself away early, then he's a blitzer on the play. Well, they had eight of those in the game. They were all singles. So 0.24 per play of 8 out of 34. They got 10 yards on those eight plays. It included all three sacks. Mm-hmm. So they averaged, minus 10 yards on those eight plays. So it included all three sacks for minus 1.3 yards per play. The common thread there is that on all three of the Ravens sacks, Marlon Humphrey was blitzing the quarterback mm-hmm. from off ball. And and he had a hand in it. I mean, he really did. If you see him, he bulled Dawkins. And Marlon Humphrey bowling Deion Dawkins, the left tackle, into the cone is a pretty cool event, frankly. He had one free run where he missed the sack, but that set up the S-16. I just thought a very interesting set of deceptive occurrences there for Orr's defense.
Yeah, and I mean, I know we're probably going to talk about Marlon Humphrey later, but I mean, yeah, I think if you'd ask me for one word to describe why he was so good last night, it would probably be physical or some synonym for that. I mean, he's always been that type of player for a cornerback, I guess, but I feel like it's maybe been dialed up even more this season, and last night was maybe the apotheosis of that quality.
We watched him play all camp. You and I did. I thought he was very clearly the Ravens' best player either side of the football. And it includes like Lamar Jackson, Derrick Henry. You know, you don't really ever get too much from running backs in camp. Right. You get a lot from corners because they make plays on the football. But I thought just he was fantastic. He knew where he was seeing the ball coming at him, meaning looking back for the football better than I've ever seen before. Because if you had to pick something out of Marlon's game that wasn't that good, it's been he's not as bad as Brandon Stevens as not being able to find the ball, and he's nowhere near as bad as JAD at not being able to find the ball in the air. But he's also not the best. He's not like a Dwayne Starks, say, used to be in terms of finding the football in the air, looking back for it.
Yeah, I mean, I would never say that he has elite ball skills. I mean, you know, he's, I mean, again, physicality, versatility, all those. I mean, if you're talking about Marlon Humphrey as a top-notch cornerback, those are the adjectives you use. But I mean, you know, he's not Marcus Peters either, right? I mean, he doesn't have that extra gear as a playmaker.
Yeah. Do you think I'm seeing what I'm seeing though? I like the interception that he had from underneath in the, what, I guess it was the second game, right? Yeah, because Mahomes' interception went to Smith. It was the second game against the Cowboys, or maybe it was against Minshew. But one of the questions that I asked this summer was whether or not, you know, the move to safety had been discussed yet. And first of all, it looks like he has tons of juice as a corner still left, but I'm seeing a very natural fit there. I would love to see Marlon Humphrey at safety someday for the Ravens, I would hope.
We were talking about this the other day, just sort of standing around and watching practice. If that did happen, I guess I wouldn't see him as a natural backline guy though, right? I would see him more as a strong safety. I don't know. Maybe not box safety. I mean, I don't know that I would say that, but I guess I don't see him as a big time playmaker as a free safety, but I'm interested in what you would say about that.
Okay. Well, let's look at the various positions he could play, because free safety would be the last evolution in what he's doing. It kind of was for Rod Woodson. He moved to free safety after he was at corner.
Yep.
If you were to play the split field role that Jackson's in, I'm not sure he couldn't do that job better right now.
Right.
I'm not sure he couldn't play it. It's a very limited role. It's effectively what he would do in a cover three scheme, just expanded slightly, meaning he's on the back end. He's looking back. So I think it would come very natural to him. Could he play slot corner? He's already playing slot corner at a high level. He has for years. Could he play dime back? I think there's no question. He has the physicality to play dime back, and he'd be scary good in terms of what he could do there. But you'd be completely wasting him at dimeback also. A player like Hamilton, I'm a little concerned that playing him at dimeback is a moderate waste of his talents. I love having him in the middle of the field. Don't get me wrong. I love even more having him at slot corner on the strong side of the field to take away that whole side of the field.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, I guess the answer is maybe the beauty of him is you don't have to pigeonhole him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be kind of cool if he was really interchangeable with Hamilton, say, right now, and they could have the same players on the field, and they could just decide how they want to run it, and have Hamilton move up to slot, and have Humphrey move back to you know, strong safety. But honestly, I don't see him as being like a Bernard Pollard or a guy who just needs to come downhill. Tony Jefferson be good, another good example. And those guys are very different personality wise, but in terms of their style of play, they're both downhill run fit players. And I would not want that for Marlon. I would want more for him to be a ball hockey back end guy, honestly.
Well, and in terms of the bigger picture of the secondary this year, it's harder to say after this year because of the, you know, Brandon Stevens contract. But I mean, this year at least, having Wiggins added to the mix, and you know, they're growing confidence in him based on what he did last night. I mean, that allows you to embrace more of these possibilities with Marlon, right? I mean, that's one of the advantages of that draft pick.
Now, one thing that I was thinking about today and just figuring, you know, how is it even possible they're going to sign all these games? Guys, they have Stevens coming up, and they have other players who are coming up this offseason too. For Ben Cleveland, for example, is coming up. I don't think the Ravens will make an – there's no evidence they'll make an effort to re-sign him.
No.
Stevens, I think it might be too late for them to get the deal done, because most guys, you want to get it a year before. Once they've already gambled on playing well, they want to get cashed out in terms of what they do. So it may be too late unless they can get it done by the end of the regular season. But then they have a number of big names who this is the ideal time to sign them this offseason. And I kind of want to get your impression on how you would rank the importance of these guys. But you've got Owe, who'll be after 4 years, but before the fifth year deal. So this is the optimal time to sign him to a long-term guy. You've got Linderbaum coming up. Hamilton, actually, they still have the fifth year option, so they can wait until the 2025 after 2025 to sign him before year four, between year four and five. I had a list of players today in a tweet that I did, and I know there's a couple more. Travis Jones. Okay. What do you do about him at this point? And then there's one other, and who am I not thinking of that's in that group? But I kind of wanted to get your opinion on this. If you would care to do this, if your position means, hey, you'd rather not, I'll understand that as well. In terms of how you would order these guys that they really have to try and prioritize for re-signing.
No, I don't mind doing it. In terms of prioritize, I mean, and of course, where the person on the other side of the table is part of that, right? I mean, it's not always about what you want to do. It's a lot of times it's about what they want to do. So I do think that Owe is playing himself into a position where you have to make a real push there, just because they have struggled to develop players at that position relative to other positions, at least. It certainly seems like he is finally becoming a very nice developmental story, and that they absolutely did the right thing in picking up his option. So if there's any way you could get that piece of business done without him getting close to the open market, where we know guys at that position get paid astronomically, I mean, that's certainly something that I would want to do. I would be very aggressive on Travis Jones. I don't know how he'll feel about that, but I mean, I think he has potential to be an enormous impact player at that spot. I mean, we're starting to see that. I mean, I know I was certainly not the only one who had this idea, but I mean, I wrote a story about him early in camp saying, you know, if you're looking for the Ravens' next breakout defensive star, it's Travis Jones. I mean, he's got the obvious components, and everybody in camp is talking about how you just can't block the guy. And we're seeing that on the field now, and he's more important by the week. If there's any way where you can take advantage of the fact that maybe his statistics don't blow your eyes out after this season, and you can get him on any kind of bargain, I would be very aggressive about that. As you said, you have a little more wiggle room with the draft picks, where you have the fifth year. So, I mean, you maybe can afford to wait a little bit there. Although, I mean, to me, of all those guys, I mean, Kyle Hamilton is the one that I would think of as a guy who maybe in the Ravens' Ring of Honor one day, and that we may be talking about as sort of a signature player for the franchise. I mean, you could see him being right next to Lamar as the guys that we think of as the defining Ravens of you know, this era, this decade, this era. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's going to be huge at some point. And I mean, their history certainly is that they don't let guys like that walk out the door. So, I mean, that's, was there anybody else on the list?
So here's the entire list. Cause I remembered the last player. So Owe, Linderbaum, Jones, Likely, who we didn't mention yet.
Yeah.
Very important. Ardarius Hamilton, of course, but he's a year deferred really from the others. Ardarius Washington is a guy who's probably, you know, a step down from some of these guys, but might be a guy you really try and get on a bargain after this season if you can.
Right. I mean, does he become a defensive version of a Justice Hill, right?
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
But I think Isaiah Likely is a guy they're going to have to make a choice on. All of their three tight ends have their deals expire the same year. And Likely and Kolar on their rookie deals, and Andrews is on the last year of his deal in 25, and they're going to have to make a choice. Honestly, I don't see with all these guys coming due.
Yeah, I think the painful reality is you're going to have to decide if it's just time to go with the younger guy, right? I mean, as great as Andrews has been, and as much as he's been one of the three or four core players on the team over the last 5 years, you could argue you have a guy who is younger and at least as good, if not better than him now. And you are facing a tough choice and you can't sign everybody if you have a franchise quarterback. So I tend to agree with you there. That's going to be that's going to come to a head.
Yeah. They have some other tough choices they may have to make on Patrick Ricard, on Patrick McCary, whose contracts are up after this year. That they just may not be in the cards. We'll have to see how those guys. I think it really is a matter of the guy opposite the table and whether or not they want to hang around. Ronnie Stanley is another one.
Yeah,
boy, I mean, he's playing well again.
Absolutely.
If you know Ronnie obviously way better than I do, and here's my question for you: is there any possibility of even a marginal hometown discount where he would say, yeah, maybe I could stay here and be in the Ring of Honor? Because I think that's on the table for Ronnie already if he stays one more contract with the Ravens, even 3 years, say.
I think if the market for him is modest, yes. But if he has a great season and there's a big market for him, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree.
That's, you know, I think he would still like to get another big deal if there's another big deal on the table.
Yeah. Okay, and I agree with you on that entirely. So, all right. Well, great discussion. Really appreciate you every time you come on the show, Chaz. We'll hang around. We'll talk about some individual performances, do a little more mailbag in part two. But for right now, tell folks where they can find your work and what their general kind of your schedule is for the week writing for the Sun.
Yeah, BaltimoreSun.com is where you can find everything. You have the five things we learned from the game, which posts at 5 a.m. the morning after every game. So that's kind of the signature thing every week. And then I do the scouting report looking ahead to the next game, which usually drops on Thursday morning. So that's a, you know, kind of an element by element breakdown of the game ahead. And then you will usually find at least one other significant feature from me in a given week. I mean, like last week I wrote about, you know, the situation that Mark Andrews is in with, you know, people around the country, especially fantasy owners, talking about, you know, where is he gone and kind of his thoughts on that. And, you know, the thoughts of some other people around him on that. So that would be an example of the type of other thing I might write in the course of the week. And then of course we're as a group dealing with whatever news comes up throughout the week.
Now your preview for the game, which is it's like Ravens passing offense versus opponent passing defense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So that comes out on Friday?
Usually posts Thursday morning. And then it'll run in print on game day.
Okay.
So if you're a print subscriber, you'll get that every Sunday. Yep.
I am still an old man at the table eating my cereal with the newspaper. So I'm very much, I wasn't even aware that this was available earlier, but I appreciate that. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, hit us up. DMs are always open on Twitter. I'd love to hear from you, particularly if you have any kind of a narrow topic. If you're looking for the shows, I'm going to give you one time through. Here's the weekly order of shows. So we have a double episode of defense that comes out on Tuesday. We have a double episode of offense comes out on Wednesday. Know Your Foe is usually the next show out.
It usually comes out on Thursday. We have one last thing, usually the same day. On Friday, you have Friday morning GMs. And on Friday and Saturday, you have the two matchups episodes for offense and defense for 9 total pods per week. Really appreciate the loyalty. Listens are fantastic. Really appreciate you guys. And have you spread the show. Anything more you can do, I really appreciate. If you're on YouTube, like and subscribe. If you're not, that's cool. Show an old man how to use the computer to play a podcast directly, even if he doesn't have a podcast, is always my way. Childs, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. And I know we'll keep rolling here.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and Watch or Tap, also on them.
Service plan required for Watch or Tap. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.